Good morning, everyone. And as Tobin said, thank you for coming to be with us in this this wonderful session this morning. My name is Sarah Mart. I work at a public health nonprofit called Alcohol Justice in San Rafael, California. Some of you may have known us several years ago by the name Marin Institute. We changed our name in 2011. So that is who we are, and I want to start off right away this morning by acknowledging and thanking, even though he's not here, my co-investigator and colleague in this legislative monitoring crime that we do all the time, Ryan Treffers, who probably works with, if not folks of you in this room, many people that you know. He's an amazing legal and legislative research analyst. So we'll go from there. We have no relationships. Neither one of us has any relationships to disclose. So not to belabor or bore any of you here at 8:30 in the morning on a Wednesday at APHA, you know all of this data, but of course we need to start out with it at least to remind about the reason that we do this work and the reason that we are monitoring and taking a look at the legislative actions going on across the states in the U.S. In addition to being the third leading preventable cause of death in the U.S., with, you know, nearly 90,000 deaths annually, almost 4,500 under age 21 every year, all kinds of various urgent and immediate injuries and issues from alcohol, as well as a great deal of chronic illness and non-communicable diseases resulting from alcohol problems as well. Around 2.5 million years of potential life lost each year in the U.S. From alcohol, shortening the lives of those who died by an average of 30 years. And I always like to note, and for you all this won't be new either, but it's not only motor vehicle crashes, which is the primary thing that the public, of course, thinks about, although those most definitely still exist. This wide range of other issues remain as well. And if we're going to be thinking and talking about alcohol-related harm, especially with regard to legislative proposals and working with public health advocates and state legislatures, we need to be able to talk about the cost as well. So on an annual level from 2006, $224 billion, or $1.90 per drink, looking at lost productivity being nearly three-quarters of what that $224 billion looked like, 11% for healthcare costs, 9.4% for criminal justice costs and other costs as well. And then taking it down to the state level, excessive drinking cost states a median of $2.9 billion, and about $2 out of every $5 of that was paid by the government. And ranging, the median state cost being $2.9 billion, but ranging from $31.9, my home state of California, to $419, a little more than that, million in North Dakota. So in January of 2009, at Marin Institute at that time, we were starting state campaigns within California, as well as supporting public health advocates in other states with regard to campaigns to hopefully enact, get proposed, and then be able to enact legislation at the state level, particularly around what we called charge for harm, or in California, it was instigating a new type of mitigation fee purposefully to direct those funds toward services and programs to mitigate the harm caused from alcohol. We were also working on out-of-home advertising, especially transit advertising campaigns, and supporting folks in California and other states to do those types of campaigns. And Alcopops, and just right then, a lot of attention to alcoholic energy drinks were also on the horizon. So those were the campaigns and alcohol policy issues that we were working on, and realized that as we were both thinking about what was happening in our own state, as well as getting questions and hearing from folks in other states around, that it would be really useful to have some type of legislative monitoring and tracking. And of course, we thought of APIS, but those data and that information being so far delayed, it really couldn't give us what was happening on the ground at that moment in time. So we wanted to know what was happening right then and be able to share that with folks. So we thought that we would start monitoring state legislation about increases in taxes and or fees, or instituting new taxes or fees. We also thought we should look at legislation that would ban, restrict, or better regulate alcopops, alcoholic energy drinks, and alcohol advertising, particularly out of home and transit. And within the year, we also started watching bills to privatize state monopolies on wholesale and retail sales. And these were the aims of that, of course, to provide current information about the policies that were being introduced at the state level. And the next steps of that were to support public health and alcohol policy advocates in states. When we began it, we were thinking about those campaigns and those bills being introduced in order to strengthen and enact better alcohol policy. What we soon found was that we were paying attention to not only those, which there were some, but not very many in certain cases, but that there were also a host of legislation being proposed to actually contradict or do the exact opposite of the types of policies that we were looking for. So I have to say, as I present this information, that first of all, it's really preliminary. We're going to be working on pulling this together into a report and an article type format, but haven't gotten there yet. And so I welcome all of your input and advice as well as we move forward through this. And also to let you know that I'll be talking about the process of what we've gone through the last 5 or 6 years of doing this as well. It has shifted and mutated, as I said, not only about not just looking at proactive legislation and policies, but also in terms of definitions and types of the areas that we were looking at. But in general, overall, we have looked at, although those have somewhat shifted and changed in what they look like over time, 4 main policy areas: taxes and or fees, what we are now calling dangerous products. That started out as alcopops, then alcoholic energy drinks, and since then there have been some more different, interesting types of products in the last couple years. Advertising, particularly out of home and transit, and what we are now calling deregulation. We started out calling that simply privatization. Those were pretty, of course, easy to see, but we've also seen that the alcohol industry has a whole deregulatory agenda. We have not been able to take a look at that whole entire list, but there are certain things, certain types of policies and bills that have come up under that we're tracking and looking at now. Procedure, of course, first of all, to identify new bills and then to stay on top of those, monitor them, and update them with any activity that happens. And this all gets uploaded to our Alcohol Justice website. It's a pretty version 1.0 or 0.5, but we hope to be able to make that a more sophisticated. I think it is relatively user-friendly right now, but we'd like to improve that in the years to come. We use an online legislative service called Statescape, which compiles all state and federal legislation and provides search capabilities not only on alcohol, but on all legislation from all 50 states. And we monitor, Ryan Treffers, of course, does the monitoring once every 2 weeks during the first two-thirds of the calendar year, when more state legislatures are in session across the nation, and every 3 weeks in the last third of the year, when fewer legislatures are active. Our new bills are primarily found through search strings used in Statescape, but we can also, and we do also, hear about things first in news articles especially when things kind of burst on the scene and are getting a lot of press, such as the powdered alcohol from earlier this year and still ongoing. Web searches or word of mouth, someone calls from another state and says, hey, we're either dealing with this or have you heard about this? And then we go and take a look for them. And these are the questions that we ask with regard to doing the monitoring. So what type of alcohol policy is proposed? Does it fall into one of those four areas? Will the legislation enact new policy or maintain or remove current alcohol policy? Was a bill actually introduced or is it an administrative order? This doesn't happen very often, but especially with regard to taxes, a lot of them don't start out as a specific actual legislative proposal. They'll show up in a governor's, 1,000-page budget proposal that hasn't been introduced as legislation yet, as the various stakeholders are arguing and negotiating in the back rooms. And if those show up in news articles and such, we'll hear about it and try to get a copy of it, and then monitor to see whether or not whatever alcohol policy is contained in that governor's budget proposal actually makes it to the end. And then in the end, it does have to be actually proposed as legislation in order to get approved. Does the bill move through the various committees? Does it pass both houses in a bicameral state, or one house in a unicameral state? Does the governor sign or veto the bill, or did she or he let it lie, and what effect did that have? Depending on the state, if a governor gets passed a legislative proposal but doesn't sign it, that can either mean that it actually is enacted or that it doesn't pass. So this is just taking a look at, again, the types of policy bills and what was contained in those that we tracked. As we all know, the various seminal works, essentially, from the Community Guide to Preventive Services, from Alcohol No Ordinary Commodity, the WHO Global Strategy, and the little one down in the corner is also the Effectiveness and Cost Effectiveness from Anderson et al. In 2009. We know the types of policies that we should be looking for. This is, again, just the raw numbers and the raw data from the various years. Over the last six years, we're looking at about 530 bills that were introduced. Ones with positive public health effects that were enacted include new alcohol taxes and fees, various banned or restricted, again, we're calling them dangerous products. It started out as alcoholic energy drinks in 2009 and into 2011, moved into this past year, Maryland banned the Vapertini, vaporized alcohol products. Louisiana, South Carolina, Michigan, and Vermont so far have banned powdered alcohol. That was a little jumping out in front of it proactively once that came around, so that was great to see. And then you'll see privatization of state control was voted down in 2009 in Washington State, but of course they came back later and took care of that. We have looks at bills with positive public health effects that did not pass. So we see quite a few of those, actually, that were proposed, which is wonderful, but then did not pass. Does not necessarily mean that they actually went all the way to a vote on the floor and were voted down, but they may have just died in committee along the way. And then ones in terms of negative public health effects that were passed include essentially decreasing taxes or fees, expanding alcohol advertising, both the location or geographic area or types of advertising that are allowed, and then taking a look at the dangerous products specific to Alka-Pops, trying to think which state it was. I don't have it off the top of my head, but one state actually proposed and then approved the TTB definition of flavored malt beverage, which has to do with allowing up to 51% of spirits to be included in the product of flavored malt beverage, which is taxed as beer or malt beverage. And then to actually, of course, privatize or other deregulation. One of the things that we're specifically looking at in terms of the other types of deregulation is both tastings as well as sales at farmers markets. There are bills happening across the country, and it started with wine, as often happens with a lot of these deregulatory or chipping away at the three-tier system and the regulatory system. Wine and small wineries might start out getting an exemption or getting a bill passed that allows them to do something like this. And next thing, especially the craft brewers, but the brewers are there the following year to say, we need that exemption too. And then we're seeing the distillers also following up and saying, no, we need that exemption too. They don't often happen in the same year. Often it's subsequent, and one gets a success, the next one comes and says, yes, we need that too. And we've heard from it. We've experienced it in California, but also in Michigan, Alaska, New York. I mean, it's on the agenda for both offering tastings and sales of alcohol at farmers markets. And then we see that there were obviously bills with potential negative public health effects that did not pass either, and quite a few of them. An interesting thing about that I like to bring up is that all it takes for the lobbyists to be able to be in the room and for the contributions to flow is a bill. So whether it's a bill that we would want or a bill that the industry would want, it gives the lobbyists who are there anyway something to either promote or oppose and a reason to be there. And, I mean, of course, they are there. That's what they're paid to do. So just a few considerations, things that we're thinking about as we're working with this at this point in time. Of course, excise taxes, none of them in any of the states are set up to increase with inflation. So essentially no action to raise them is essentially the same as lowering an ad valorem tax on alcohol. Even after many bills were introduced, especially in the frenzy, if any of you recall, around alcoholic energy drinks and a little bit associated with that around alcohol pops, not many of them actually pass. And so what we see from different legislators is that it can be a really, you know, they can feel really good about introducing something, but that doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that it's going to succeed. So that was something, you know, we were getting really excited, and folks in states were getting excited around, you know, lots and lots of legislation around these products, but then what we see, what actually passed, not so much. And we've seen, I think there was one bill a few years ago to ban supersized alcopops, essentially the 23.5 to 24 ounce large cans, started out with Four Loko or Blast or what have you, but now, you know, we see it with the Bud Light Limeritas and the rest of their, basically almost every brand has one of these types of products, and many of them have high alcohol content as well, so as much as, you know, up to four or five standard drinks in one can. We haven't seen any successful action to rein that in. And like I said, with the powdered alcohol, that's been interesting. For any of you who don't know, it was a product that was approved by the TTB, but then pulled back essentially once it got to the media that it had been approved. To my knowledge, as of this point, it hasn't. The producer is going through the motions to get TTB approval again, but hasn't yet. But some states have been proactive in banning the sale of that in their state. We see, you know, a lot of, like I said, proposals for the so-called dangerous products. Maybe those are easier to introduce and pass, but we also don't necessarily have information about how effective they are at actually reducing harm. So again, maybe that feels good to do that sort of thing, but we're not sure. And the economic, the whole economic argument that we hear, it's primary from the industry, has shifted a little bit over time, and this is from, not from the legislation itself, although sometimes in the legislative analysis, but of course, 2009, 2010, 2011, it was the economic sky is falling. And perhaps that was why there were some more alcohol tax increase proposals or new taxes or fees at that time. However, 2012, 2013, 2014, the last few years, that has shifted. It's not the economic sky is falling in the crisis mode that it was, but it's about economic development, it's about jobs, it's about all of these things that that the industry uses. And we see fewer alcohol policy bills overall in election years, so 2010, 2012, 2014. Very few. Shouldn't surprise any of us, really. This last one is just kind of something that has occurred to us as we've been watching over the years. New York State, for instance, will have anywhere from 3 to 6 different legislative proposals that say exactly the same thing. It's very, seems to be very important, and from what I've heard from folks from New York State, they agree that different legislators need to have their legislation proposed and out there, but they don't pass overall most all the time. Whereas in California, where we are, it's incredibly hard to even get a proactive alcohol policy piece of legislation proposed. So just interesting to watch the different sides of the country on that. I wanted to say a little bit just about what's going on in terms of the industry spending, while at the same time we're tracking these legislation. Over the years, we also pay attention to what's going on in the states with regard to how much the alcohol corporations are spending on contributions to candidates as well as incumbents and their political action committees, as best we can, of course, whatever we can find that's reported, as well as their lobbying dollars. So this is totals for 2014. We're looking at approximately, and this doesn't change too much, a little bit in election years, but almost $20 million in some years. Looks like $19 million so far reported in 2014 across the states. The ones that are white obviously haven't gotten their reporting done yet. But anywhere from $3 million donated in Texas, $2 million in California, $1 million New York, $2 million in Florida, down to, you know, just a couple $1,000s in various rural states. And again, just to look at some of the top alcohol contributors, I include the United States in this column because the contributors obviously contribute to congressmen and women. At the same time, those are from they represent the states, and so when the lobbyists go in and can be speaking about the various federal bills, proposals to reduce the alcohol taxes, so there are several currently that would reduce beer taxes, also one that would reduce distilled spirits for, you know, craft distillers. As they're doing that, they can also be speaking about what's going on at the state level and interacting on that. So the influence can flow in a variety of ways. And these are really, I mean, it can change from year to year, but these are really the overall big spenders in terms of contributions. This is just another look at it. I know it's really tiny. I'm happy to share slides with anybody after this. But these were lobbying clients at the federal level, too. And just a look at what they've been spending over time. And these are from, if anyone's not familiar, both the Center for Responsive Politics at opensecrets.org, as well as the National Institute for Money and State Politics, also known as followthemoney.org. So, in terms of who's spending the money and who is out there, especially doing the lobbying with our legislators, of course, the major trade groups, Distilled Spirits Council, Beer Institute, Wine Institute. For anyone who didn't know, I'd just like to bring up, because it's happened relatively recently, the Century Council, the arm of the DISCUS, Distilled Spirits Council, has changed its name to the Foundation for Advancing Alcohol Responsibility. And that has also shown up in the Follow the Money and Open Secrets, so you don't need to worry about that. They've done it for you. But important, and especially taking a look at that, the difference between the Century Council and the rest of their tagline did include in very tiny print that they were distillers or distilled spirits. However, now it's the same companies, it's the same org operating under DISCUS, but it's the Foundation for Advancing Alcohol Responsibility. And we see that the whole idea of responsibility and that terminology is really coming to the forefront in the industry's agenda. As with this, I've overlaid the logos and pages for these two groups, which have merged this year, the Global Alcohol Producers Group and then the International Center for Alcohol Policies, or ICAP. Their new name is the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking, and it is all the same corporations again, maybe with a few new ones added in. And of course, these are both active on a global level, certainly not only in the United States at all, but have headquarters in Washington, D.C., and are most definitely there and present with our leadership. So something to pay attention to in the years to come. And this from DISCUS and their industry review presentation to their members and to their industry leaders. U.S. market modernization, quote unquote, the industry term for deregulation, expands access and opportunity, of course. Legislatures continue to restrain hospitality taxes, so that's the other word for alcohol taxes. Tax threats, quote-unquote, were defeated in 18 out of 19 states. I can't remember what their time frame was, but relatively recently. And they're very proud of, since 2001, according to them, we don't have these numbers, so I don't know, can't break down what this means, what type of legislation, except for, well, I'll say something in a second, but 336 out of 365, or approximately 92-93% of what the industry considered tax threats, were defeated. They were successful in that. I lost it, but it'll come back to me about that one. They defeated major municipal tax proposals in Chicago and Philadelphia. They're obviously working not only on the state and federal level, but in local communities. We all know that and can see that local alcohol elections continue to favor modernization, according to them. And again, going after expanded spirits tastings, whether that's in grocery stores, actual alcohol stores, alcohol-only stores, or like I said, in various other places, for nonprofit groups to raise money, they may do tastings and need to pass legislation to have a different kind of permit for that. And as I said, with, for instance, the farmers markets. And they're looking for bans on Sunday sales, or to remove bans on Sunday sales and election day alcohol sales. And from then on, I mean, they have much more on their agenda as well. And this is the language they use. So this is what we're seeing in the legislative analyses and in the legislation being proposed. So they're looking to modernize their words, again, all of this, versus, again, what they see as antiquated. Economic development is first and foremost for whatever else it is that they're proposing. It's all about that. Not necessarily with connections, actual data, or data that we can verify or validate. Consumer convenience, putting it in the hands of the consumer, of course, even though we do know there are polls out there that say that consumers, drinkers, citizens, actually do support both state control as well as various state regulations that we know are important too. To clean up mess left over after Prohibition 75 plus years ago, overhaul, update, simplify, streamline, reinvent, safeguard against the nanny state, Again, of course, to provide easier, more access and availability, addressing consumer needs. These are all industry needs, what they're addressing, not consumers necessarily. And essentially, the industry defines public health and effectiveness. Diageo, or no, Discus, although I wouldn't be surprised if Diageo did too. Discus has hired two different executive level vice presidents or that level type person specifically to advance the industry's quote-unquote public health or scientific health agenda. And they're doing it very well in op-eds and letters and lobbying and, you know, actual personal appearances or their materials in states across the nation. Meanwhile, according to the industry, so as they define public health for themselves, public health advocates are defined as anti-alcohol, anti-jobs, anti-business, anti-community. So this is what Alcohol Justice does. If any of you don't know, my contact info is here. I'm happy to speak with anybody afterwards. Thanks.